All right, the book of Proverbs, chapter 1, we're going to read the first seven verses again and then turn directly to, after that, to our questions that have been submitted by the congregation. And like I said, I got a lot of good questions this week. In fact, there was one question I really couldn't get definitive on because of several reasons with it, but I did glean some wisdom from it. And I trust it was a help to them also. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, to know wisdom and instruction, to discern the sayings of understanding, to receive instruction in wise behavior, righteousness, justice, and equity, to give prudence to the naive or to the simple, and to the youth knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear an increase in learning, and a man of understanding will acquire wise counsel. To understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. And so I've got three questions here. Lord willing, we'll be able to cover those. And Lord willing, have a little time left over for our prayer time tonight. One of them I booked in. One of them is kind of lengthy. The last one's kind of lengthy. And the middle one is not as lengthy. So give you a good variety here tonight. So let's turn to Proverbs chapter 18. And we'll begin in verse 16. A man's gift makes room for him and brings him before great men. And the question is, the first part of the verse seems to condone a practice similar to bribery. What is the interpretation of the verse, and what is a real world application of this verse? And I've heard this verse frequently, especially from a particular friend of mine who's in the ministry who quotes it from the pulpit rather frequently. And definitely a very, very interesting verse. So let me just give you some help with the verse, and then we'll go in and try to answer that. You got the word gift there in Proverbs 18 and verse 16, and that is really a general word for giving. It can denote a person of generosity, that when a person gives generosity, it's like giving a gift to people. It doesn't necessarily have to be money, okay, but just a man who is generous. So a man's gift makes room for him. The word room there refers to extending an area or enlarging an area. And really, it's probably used in the sense of to create an opportunity. Okay, so that's probably the sense in which it's being used here. Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 20 talks about extending boundaries, and Deuteronomy 19 and verse 8 talks about enlarging an area. So it kind of gives you the sense of what that Hebrew phrase is referring to. And so, literally, a man's gift creates a wide space for him and leads him before great men, or it conducts him, it escorts him to great men. Now, to answer the question here, as I've kind of hinted at, the word gift is a neutral term. In other words, it doesn't necessarily mean a bribe. It can include a bribe, but it doesn't necessarily mean a bribe. And, you know, when we think of the word bribe, we always think of it in a negative way, don't we? Okay? In other words, if I say to you, I bribed somebody, your eyes would get big. You would wonder what I did. What was I trying to pervert? But really, a bribe can be used even in a good way. It's not used that way in the English language. I looked it up in an English dictionary, and it almost always, in all the definitions, refers to something negative or something evil. So I think when we use the word bribe, and I think when they're using the word bribe, they're thinking evil. Okay, something bad that shouldn't be done, or to pervert justice type of thing. Like you bribe a judge, and then they rule in your what? They rule in your favor. So, since gift is a neutral term, it can be understood in a good sense, or it could be understood in a negative sense. If you're using it in a good sense, it would be like a courtesy. For example, when I lived in the Middle East, in the particular geographical location where my wife and I were at, when you went to visit someone, you actually left your apartment. Remember when we could do that? When you could leave your home and go visit somebody, you would take them flowers. Okay? And it was a show of courtesy. Now, if I give you flowers, am I giving it to you? Okay? But am I perverting evil? Am I trying to get you to do evil? The answer to that is no, right? And that's, in this case, I'm doing something cultural. You could take chocolate sometimes in that type of sense. That'd be a good gift, wouldn't it? You'd invite me over quite frequently if I would give you chocolate. All the children would anyway. And so a man's gift that makes room for him or creates opportunity for him can be used in a good sense. It also can be used in a relational sense, a relationship. If I'm, to use the flower illustration, if I'm dating my wife and I go and purchase some flowers, okay, and I give them to her, I'm not trying to get her to do evil, right? Okay, what am I showing her with my gift? Okay, she says love. Could be I'm showing my favor to her, right? I'm showing that I take her in a very special way. I just don't give flowers to any lady that's out there, right? Okay, but am I giving it to her? I am giving it to her. And in this sense, if I give my wife flowers, it might create opportunity for a wedding one day, right? If we keep doing that. And so, but I'm not doing it for evil. If you use the word gift here in an evil sense, it would be like, as I mentioned, bribing to pervert justice or to try to get your way or to get around something. And I think probably here in this verse, it's referring to something in a good sense. And the reason why I kind of land in that direction is that the Lord would never condone giving for the purpose of evil. You agree with that? Okay, so in our use of the word bribe, okay, the Lord would not say, now, go bribe your way through life, okay? But would he say, be generous? He would say, be generous, be giving. And so our expressions, I would come out of this verse in this way. Our expressions of true generosity strengthens relationships. And in strengthening those relationships, it does create opportunities. In other words, it does, how can I word this? Flavor. It does favor the person to be good to me, right? If I'm good to them, they're more likely to show good to who? To me. And so it would be like you had a good friend and, you know, there's been mutual giving and you have a strong relationship. And then you hear about a job that opens and immediately you don't think of the one that's being evil to you, right? You think of, hey, my friend needs a job and this seems perfect for him. What did that do? It created what? Created opportunity, didn't it? And so our expressions of true generosity strengthens our relationships. Favors shown to others can create a bond of love, right? It can bring you into more favor with that person. It can bring you into opportunities. It can enlarge opportunities. It can extend opportunities that are out there. And I think that's what Solomon is referring to here, that a generous man creates opportunities for himself, even to the place where he can appear before who? Great men, mighty men, because of his gifting. I don't think that it's referring to bribes. Now, I also don't think that it refers to the gifts of the Spirit. Now, it is true that if a man has a spiritual gift, as he uses it in a local church, people recognize the gift, and it does open opportunities for the man to use that gift. Am I right about that? That is right, but that's not what this verse is teaching. Okay, this is more about generosity with that. So let me give you a couple of examples. Let's go to 1 Samuel 17. 1 Samuel chapter 17. And probably if I say 1 Samuel 17, what are you thinking? David and Goliath. You say, where in the world, where are you getting a gift out of that? Okay, David and Goliath. Well, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, the scripture tells us that David was the youngest, and his brothers were at war. They were with Saul. And David kept the sheep. But one thing that David would do is that he would periodically, with his father's blessing, that he would take trips to go check on how his brothers were doing and how the war was doing and what was going on. And then he'd come back and tell Dad what was going on. They didn't have the internet, and they didn't have nightly news and the radio. Okay, so this is how you got news. And his father would have been interested, right, in such things. But I want you to note that in verse 17 of 1 Samuel 17, Jesse, who was his father, told David to take to his brothers an ephod of roasted grain and 10 loaves and give them to his brothers. Okay, everybody see that? Now note verse 18. He said, bring also 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their thousand, and look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them. Okay, now what was Dad doing with the commander of the brothers? I'm going to say platoon, okay? What was he doing? Generous. Yeah, he was being generous to the commander in hopes that, yeah, he would show some favor and David could go in and communicate to his brothers and get news and then go back. Okay, do you think this was bad or good? That's a good thing, right? He's not perverting justice. He's not trying to get around. He's not trying to promote evil. But did he give a gift? He did. He did give a gift. Let's turn to another one. I got three here. Genesis chapter 32. And in Genesis 32, Jacob is coming back to the land, and he's got a problem. What's the problem? The problem's Esau. Okay. And Esau said that he stole his birthright, and so there's rift. There's relationship issues here. And Esau's a mighty man, and he's got several families and cities, and he's a ruler. And so Jacob is on the way back at God's command. And in verse 20, you'll remember that he divided his company up into threes. And he did that so there'd be a first group that met Esau, and if they died, there'd be another group. And if maybe he'd get tired of bloodshed by the time he got to Jacob. But in any case, you'll notice that in verse 19, he commanded also the second and third and all those who followed the drove, saying, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. For he said, Now note what he said in his heart. I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward, I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp. So is Jacob sending a present? What's he hoping to do with that present? Appease the anger of his brother, right? And you think that that's evil or good in this case? It's not evil. I would say it's not evil, right? We don't know. It's not saying God condones it or he doesn't condone it. But it's definitely not bribery, right? He's not trying to pervert anything. He's trying to calm down the situation there. So go over to Genesis chapter 43. And this is years later. And you'll recall that Israel sent his sons down into Egypt. They kept the youngest, you remember that, and sent it back. And what happened as they sent it back? Well, they had the money in the satchels, and so he goes back, and now they're out of food. Verse 11. Then their father Israel said to them, "If it must be so, then do this. Take some of the best products of the land in your bags and carry down to the man as a what? As a present." Everybody see that? A little balm, a little honey, aromatic gum, myrrh, pistachio nuts, and almonds. See, that was rich food back then, right? You just go to the store and buy a sack of almonds, okay? Look at verse 12. "Take double the money in your hand and take back in your hand the money that was returned in the mouth of your sacks. Perhaps it was a mistake. Take your brother also. Arise, return to the man, and may God Almighty grant you compassion in the sight of the man so that he will release to you your other brother and Benjamin. And as for me, if I'm bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the men took this present and they took double the money in their hand and Benjamin, and they went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. Okay, is he giving a gift? Okay, why? He's looking for favor, isn't he? Okay. Is that good or bad? I mean, is he trying to pervert justice? No, but he's trying to create opportunity. He's trying to appease the situation. He's trying to get favor from the man, right? And so that kind of gives you three instances scripturally that show you what I think that Proverbs 18 and verse 16 is referring to. Now, bribery for the point of gain and covetousness and evil and perverting of justice and unrighteousness and injustice, all of that is bad. All of that is evil. The Lord doesn't condone evil. Okay? Does that help? All right, the next verse is the very next verse. Proverbs 18 and verse 17. Proverbs 18, verse 17. "The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him." And the question is, what does the first half mean? Well, I would put it simply this way, and I think this is very helpful, especially in our culture, in our days of sound bites, in our day of not really wanting to take the time to think through situations. And this is probably a legal situation, but I think it has broader application. And that is, one should not form an opinion until they hear all sides. Okay. When a person comes to you and they want to tell you, here's an issue and here's why it's an issue, they're always persuasive, right? I mean, you'll sit there and you'll say, yeah, I can see that. Mm-hmm. Okay. If you form your opinion just on that, you're probably going to be wrong. For instance, when I counsel married people and the wife comes and gives me a problem, and there's been many times I'm listening to this problem and my heart is just squeezed and it's like, oh, I'm so, inside I'm thinking, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry this is going on. You got such a mean husband. Outside I'm smiling, I'm listening, I'm nodding, and inside I'm telling myself, get all the facts. Okay? Because people can really tell you a story and draw you in, can't they? Media can do that. Internet can do that. Facebook can do that. Debates can do that. Okay? That's why I like to read. And if it's a serious enough situation, for instance, if you're addressing something scripturally, you actually have to read both sides. You just can't read the side that you like. You have to read both sides in order to understand where everybody is coming from. So, one should not form an opinion until he hears all sides, because the first side is probably persuasive until the other side is heard. Okay, and that's why in a courtroom, right, you get a witness who comes up and answers questions, and then what happens? The other side gets to cross-examine, right? And I realize sometimes they're trying in an evil way, but the point is they're supposed to be getting all sides of the facts, right? Questions can be worded in a way that draws out a certain answer from you. And I love these surveys you get, you know, say, here, take a survey. You know, do you agree that women should be beaten? Yes or no? You know, and of course, no. Okay, then they go and report. 98% of Americans think that women are being beaten, you know, and it's just a general type thing, and they can word things to get your agreement. I won't share details, but I had a marital situation many, many years ago, and I'd been dealing with it for a while. The woman came to me, and she started giving me all the reasons why she ought to divorce this man. I mean, scriptural reasons, personal reasons, abuse reasons. I mean, I was just listening for about 10 or 15 minutes. And I realized after listening to her that she was going to try to get me to agree with her. And then she would say, Pastor said, it's okay. In other words, all these other reasons were nothing. She was wanting me to give the reasons so that she could say, it's my fault. I'm the one that gave the reason. And thankfully, the Lord opened my eyes and I was able to dodge that. And I really did dodge that. Because when I gave her the answer, her whole countenance just fell. And then she left. She never did divorce the man. Thankful for that. And they both stayed. So anyway, you just need that wisdom. So hopefully that helps. The first one you hear in pleading a case seems right or seems persuasive, but wait to hear the other side. Okay, everybody say it. Every parent knows that, right? Okay. He hit me. Why did he hit you? Well, you find out they hit them first. Okay, well, it doesn't excuse you hitting, right? But it also doesn't excuse the other person from hitting. And I can't tell you the number of times I've told my wife, I would have never thought that this was the situation. I thought it was going in this direction. I got all the facts, and I couldn't believe that this is what was happening. So be sure to do that. Take the time, depending on the gravity of the situation, take the time to get all the facts that you need. All right, lastly, chapter 19 and verse 18. And we actually had two people asked about this verse. And I remember when I read this verse, I kind of caught my eyebrow a little bit. It says, discipline your son while there is hope and do not desire his death. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? That this is a parental bad day. This is the day someone shows up and you have, you know, buy one, get one free, and the price is zero. This isn't a parental bad day verse here, so I'll just let you know that right off. So discipline your son while there is hope, and do not desire his death. One person said, what does this mean? And the other person wrote, do not desire his death. Is this a father desiring his son's death? And is this caused by a father's frustration? And actually, it's the exact opposite. Okay, so let me explain. The word discipline here means to rebuke or to chastise. So, again, when you read discipline, don't always think punitive, although after you read do not desire his death, you may be thinking along those lines, okay? But it really is to rebuke or to chastise your son or your daughter. While there is hope, and the word hope there means hope of the outcome, hope of outcome. In other words, what are you hoping for when you discipline or chastise or rebuke a child? What are you hoping for? Yeah, you're hoping for correct behavior, right? You're hoping for them not only to do it at the moment, you want them to accept the wisdom and change their behavior. So discipline your son while there is hope and do not desire his death. And like I mentioned, you know, this isn't a father frustrated. This isn't a father deciding, I'm just going to kill you. You desire your child's death when you withhold discipline. Everybody see that? Discipline your son while there's hope. If you withhold the discipline, you're desiring his death. In other words, the wages of wrong behavior, I'm not using sin, the wages of wrong behavior is death, right? And so it's actually the exact opposite here. So I worded it this way. A parent should provide rebuke and correction while there is still hope for change. Obeying a desire to not challenge their wrong behavior means you are welcoming the outcome of the bad behavior, which is death. Right? The wages of sin is death. That's spiritual, right? When we stand before God. But if you don't walk in the ways of the Lord, if you don't walk in the way of life, then you're walking in the way of what? Of death. And so your children end up, as the Bible, as Proverbs says, loving death, walking in death, drinking death. Ultimately, they die, they stand before the Lord, and they're spiritual dead. Okay? So a parent should provide correction, rebuke, while there is hope for change. And children probably don't understand this, but, you know, a good parent hates to do this. They don't wake up in the morning and say, I just can't wait to correct my children. Okay? Many a parent has come to me and made this statement. I feel like all I do is say no. All day long. No, 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 no. Don't do that. Okay? Parents, you ever felt that way other than me? Yep. Okay? And so, you know, And that can get to the place where you just decide, I'm just not going to deal with it. A church can be that way in church discipline situations, right? You just don't want to what? You just don't want to deal with it. And ultimately, having that type of desire of not challenging wrong behavior means that you are desiring not their life, that's the way of wisdom, but they're what? They're death. You're settling them into their wrong behavior. And so I think we all know this. True love, God's love, desires the good of another. Right? So if I desire the good, as a pastor, if I desire the good for my congregation, I can exhort you in a positive way, but there are times I need to exhort you also in a what? In a negative way. But if I say, I just want to be a positive kind of guy, you know, not pointing out anything, not, you know, always speaking in the choir, avoiding subjects that might cause division, but God has spoken definitively about, I'm not desiring the good of the congregation, right? I'm actually desiring their what? Their death. They're dying. That's the same way with a parent. A parent that loves his children will raise them under correction. Instruction, remember Proverbs chapter 4, instruction is the way of life. Okay, you never get too old that you don't need instruction from the Lord. And I think parents, we know this. The longer you tolerate improper behavior, the harder it is to remove it. It can actually get to the place where change is almost impossible. It's that ingrained into the person. Everybody see that? Okay. Now, when they're, look, if your child, if your child is back talking you at age 3, that's the time to instruct. That's the time to correct, right? That's the time to enforce right behavior. But if that child's back talking at age 18, how much more difficult is it? Okay, and I've often worded it this way. Sin, according to James, you have conception, like a baby. Okay. Prior to conception, stopping the sin is much easier. But once it's conceived, is it harder? Okay, how about once the sin idea in a person begins to grow? It's even harder, isn't it? It's like you have to abort the baby. That's really hard, isn't it? So, that's not an excellent illustration, but I think it illustrates the difficulty. The longer you allow improper behavior to go on, the more difficult it is, or Proverbs, the less hope you have of that behavior actually changing. Usually when they get older, it just goes undercover. I used to have teenagers, nobody here, but teenagers tell me into my ministry, well, I'm just acting this way until I get out from under my parents' roof. Now, their parents think everything's okay because on the outward, they're conforming. But really, all they did was what? They hid it. They didn't change, but they hid it. And every parent has that situation go on with their children. And may the Lord grant you not to have that. That would be, be a blessing. So everybody see that? Okay. Discipline your son while there is hope. Because if you don't discipline, you are not desiring his life, you're desiring his death. Okay? Does that kind of relax the verse a little bit, that it's not a parental outbreak? Okay. All right. Okay, well, let's go to our Lord in prayer then.